All right, we'll get started. Welcome to the Craniotomy Podcast, where we peer into the minds of those on the front lines of neuromodulation and neuropsychiatry. I am Dr. David Darrow, a neurosurgeon here with Dr. Alex Herman, a psychiatrist, and we are the co-PIs of the Herman Darrow Lab at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for joining us today for yet another very exciting episode, because today we have Dr. Villares, who is in the Department of Psychology at the University of Minnesota and also studies decision-making. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Iris.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm excited to be here.
So, Iris, we met at a computational psychiatry meeting in Washington?
Yes, in 2018, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it must have been 2018. And I was really excited, you know, and impressed by your talk. And so I was totally thrilled when I found out you'd be coming to the university and taking a faculty position. So just a wonderful development. I don't know, I guess, you know, we typically start by asking people to tell us a little bit about their background, where they're from, what their training is, and what their intellectual, you know, tell us a story about their intellectual development. So, you know, you can kind of take it from there.
Sounds good. Yeah, I don't have a very linear path, I would say. I started my undergrad actually in biology back in Portugal. So I'm European, sort of. So my father's from Portugal, my mother's from the Netherlands. And I grew up in Portugal and I studied biology in Portugal, mainly because I liked animals and I was curious about them. Then I wasn't sure at the time if I wanted to do a PhD or not. So I tried to gain more time and studied math applied to biology. And then by then I decided that yes, no, I do want to study. You know, I want to go to an academic career. I always wanted to be a teacher. Actually, my passion was always more into the teaching part, but including a lot of the research. And just I didn't just want to be, you know, just teach something over and over again. I wanted to contribute to the actual knowledge. And it changed throughout the years what kind of teacher I wanted to be, but then it ended up being, okay, I do want to be a university teacher and I do want to do a PhD because of that. And I ended up doing a PhD in neuroscience because that was the topic I found more fascinating, about how people make decisions and behavior and what is happening in the brain. And I often joke that the reason why we, you know, why we study what we study is often because it's things we are not very good at. So for certain decisions, it's very hard for me to make them. And so I'm studying decision making under uncertainty because I want to at least know theoretically what I should be doing. So then I did a PhD in neuroscience and in a postdoc also related to decision making and fMRI, both in the US and UK. And then I ended up realizing that yes, psychology department would be a better fit. And just because I worked with humans mainly and I wanted to do a lot of the teaching as well. And so, yeah, I applied and the University of Minnesota was my top choice. And one of the things was indeed like meeting people like Alex that were interested in computational psychiatry and that make it much more diverse and collaborative environment than where you'll find psychiatrists and neuroscientists and psychologists all working together. So that's how I got here. And
fantastic.
Yeah, you can ask me more questions or I can keep on going, but I didn't like vlogs for a very long time.
Interesting. So you started in biology, because I would have, you know, if I had to guess, I would have guessed you started in a quantitative field like physics or engineering or something.
No, that would have probably been good too, but no.
Because your PhD was with Conrad Cording, right?
Correct, yes.
So that's a very math-heavy, engineering-heavy lab, right?
Yes. In fact, most of the people, except for me, everybody else was either, their background was either math or physics or engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to
learn. What was that experience like?
It was good. It was good because, well, first because Conrad is an amazing supervisor, and I think a lot of the PhD experience comes from, you know, having a good supervisor, a good match in terms of supervision. What is the best supervisor for one person might not be the same for others. I was the only woman in a very male-dominated lab, so that made it, like, there were some interesting challenges there. But in general, it was a very good experience because I got to learn a lot of new things, and I could still do, still let me, because I, even though I did PhD in Conrad's lab, I had funding from the Portuguese government, actually, and from the São Paulo Lima Foundation to actually do my own research. And so it let me do things like fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging that nobody else in the lab did, and more of the human, you know, like more of the social part that nobody else in the lab did. So it was good. It was a good experience because I learned a lot. And then for my postdoc, I ended up going to something that was a bit more directly related to what I do. But I'm very happy to have had the PhD I had.
And the postdoc was with Reed Montague, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, both Conrad, the both of those scientists are, you know, heroes of mine. So, I mean, I love, you know, love and respect their work. So it's pretty impressive lineage you have.
They are very good. They are very good. And with Reed, the things we did both in Roanoke, Virginia, where he's mainly at, and it was a collaboration with University College London. And so Peter Dayan was there, and he co-supervised me occasionally, and he's also one of my heroes. They all are. So you learn a lot from them. It's very demanding. Like, if you like, you don't know anything compared to what they know, but you do learn a lot.
Okay, yeah, I mean, a few different threads to pull on there. I'm curious a little bit about the experience of being a woman in a male-dominated lab. I don't know if you have, you know, necessarily what there is you'd want to say about that, but, you know, what were the challenges and what were the ways you found of, you know, kind of surmounting them?
So, in general, it's good. Some of the challenges is that I remember there was one postdoc in the lab at the time that basically by default didn't think that women could do math as well as men. And it was so implicitly or explicit about it sometimes. And I remember other members of the lab coming and, you know, defending, well, don't you feel like should we say something? I mean, this is not, you know, like... But I said, no, this is clearly just this person. It's not specific to me. Clearly, it's just like a general belief that he has about women, that if they are good in math, that they will not stay in academia. So that the only reason, if they are, yeah, basically thought that the only reason, like, men like to stay in academia because of the competition part, but women don't have it. So there it is, kind of outdated thing. But I just ended up doing my thing and still helping him and just saying, like, okay, this is just, you know, a weird belief, but that's okay. And then what ended up happening was that even though they had a stronger background in some of the computational part, because my master's was in kind of statistics applied to biology, I knew a lot of the statistics part. And he ended up asking me questions afterwards. So he would come to me with these questions. So then he ended up realizing, oh, no, she does know something. So then that's how it worked out. And more importantly, realizing it's not something about you. It's just like a belief in the system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, but, and I would, you know, annoy my supervisor just to say, like, you know, get other women to, you know, to get in. He was like, well, they're not applying. So just he ended up getting a few more, but it's just that there's also some self-selective biases here often. But on the other hand, it was good. I was well taken care of, if you will.
And Iris, can you sort of, I guess, look at that from a bigger picture for some of these labs that, you know, are not able to incorporate a diverse opinion or approach, how that might relate to their ability to do translation, I think is the question that we have, because, you know, we think we're a very interdisciplinary lab because we span, you know, neurosurgery to psychiatry and do computational work and focused on translation. And oftentimes, you know, in many ways, a lot of successful labs are very siloed in their approach because they have tools that are very good, but, you know, have increasing specificity for what they're working on instead of, you know, the ability to reach out to big translational problems. You know, each lab develops their tool set. Their tool set gets sharper and sharper. They're very good at applying their methodology, but it becomes less and less relevant to medicine, in our case, psychiatry. And do you see any correlation there between trying to incorporate sort of that these diverse approaches coming from a background of decision making?
Yeah, I think they both have their value. So I do see the value of like a very strong specialization, and they are then become very good at this one thing. And it's kind of much easier to be on top of the literature of as well, because it's just a smaller area to cover. On the other hand, I do feel that even though, you know, I was in computational lab, my PhD lab was still pretty broad. So we had from all over. And the fact that I was there as well was made it more broad, and the type of research that they do is also quite broad. And I think having this kind of broad research, and especially everybody interacting and then coming from different fields and having different skill sets, actually helps you break the boundaries and find out or see things in one particular way. So they're both important. One maybe to you know, get deeper into certain things, but then I think it's just with this diversity that we can get a much better understanding of what's going on and see things that we are not seeing, right? Because we have, as scientists, we have our own biases that we don't even understand, because it's, we view the world in a certain way. And so the more diverse we can be, and the less, you know, the take out some of the barriers that exist, that I think that will make science better.
Mm-hmm. It's almost a weird problem where, you know, really what you want is actually, you know, everybody has their biases. It's impossible to avoid. So what you actually want is a diversification of biases.
The biases, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Different biases so that you all like...
they cancel each other out, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
I guess that comes along with sort of how the power is structured and how, you know, how you were alluding to the supervision of the lab and how it's organized and all that kind of stuff plays a big role in whether or not the diversity is effective or not effective or suppressed.
Yes, exactly. And it depends on, and it's a matter of fit often, right? So I would say my Connor has a diverse lab and he likes to do different things, and his lab shows that, and so gets very, and that really helps for people like me that also like different things and have a diverse background, and you can interact. Maybe some, on the other hand, maybe some labs that are, you know, very specialized and just do this one thing, maybe they can get a lot of papers out in the same way because it's all the same thing. So there's, you know, some different incentives there. So it's really a matter of fit. But I think, because I was lucky to be in such a lab, but different people might prefer different things.
Hmm. Yeah, this question, I think, of whether or not, because in a way, you know, this idea, or it's almost an ideal that scientific inquiry should be completely divorced from the human side of it, right? That who we are as people shouldn't have anything to do with this objective pursuit of truth, right? That the scientific process is what it is, and it has nothing to do with the people doing it. But in reality, that's not how it works, right? And I think our backgrounds and our biases and all this have a huge influence on the kinds of questions we ask and how we ask those questions. And I think rather than pretend that we should all live in this unrealistic, you know, pure ivory tower. We should embrace that, as we've been talking about, and recruit, you know, build diverse groups and institutions so that we do have this kind of like diversity of biases, as David was saying. I think that's an interesting, you know, way of thinking about it. And there's even some data, right? There've been some studies showing that, I don't know if it's gender diversity or like there's some aspect of diverse author papers that, you know, they end up having a bigger impact or something like that. But there's certainly some objective evidence for it as well.
I agree. I mean, well, of course we should, you know, ideally it would be like extremely objective, but the truth is we cannot be, even if we try to be, mm-hmm. we're still objective in our metric and pretending it's not there, then it will just make it, you know, sometimes people hear, oh, well, this was scientifically proven or a scientist said that, and then automatically assume it's all the objective, there's no mistakes that happen, and there's no biases. And that has created problems in the past, right? There's a lot of very problematic science that happened, which people had their biases because they were just humans, but then you're assuming they're like perfect scientists and this is science and this is perfect, then you can get the wrong impressions. Not that you say you shouldn't believe in science, of course you should, but like, also your own critical thinking and understand. And the more diverse we can get, I agree with you, the more diverse we can get, the probably the better we are at overcoming some of these biases.
I mean, I think, you know, along those lines, I actually think that this approach of understanding where we come from and, you know, our biases is actually the scientific one, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's promoting science at another level because you have to characterize your own biases and trying to, you know, have a group of people looking at a problem from different angles is truly a scientific one, I think. So I don't think it really violates any principles. In fact, it takes it to sort of the next level. And I think that's kind of what's missing from a lot of the publications and a lot of the, you know, historic approaches is we just have no idea what those biases were, or we don't have any way to incorporate them into understanding sort of those perspectives. So it seems like a very straightforward application of the scientific method.
It's just
we don't have very good, I guess we're just getting the generalized linear mixed effects models to incorporate the scientists as part of the mixed effect.
Should we put that in? Yeah, exactly. Should we put in demographics of the
exactly.
as a random effect in the model? I don't know.
That's right. I
don't know. Yes, the meta-analysis, yeah. Yes, that's why, like, especially labs like yours, I think, incorporate like directly the clinical side, but also the basic research side and everything between, and computational modeling to try to bridge those areas. I think it's really important.
So how did you, so like in this transition from biology to math to biology to Conrad's lab, how did you first get interested in the kinds of problems you worked on with human decision-making? I mean, I'm thinking about some of Conrad's earlier papers. I mean, the one I know best is one of these Bayesian reaching papers, which that was a human paper, right? So he was doing But I mean, what was your, you know, what kinds of things were you thinking about as a graduate student or even before graduate school?
So yeah, so when I started the grad school, I started actually this PhD program in neuroscience that was the first year that was given. There was a collaboration between the Champollion Foundation, the Gulbenkian Institute of Science in Portugal, and the equivalent of the NSF in Portugal. But it was the first year, and in fact, it was so much the first year that the Champollion Foundation building didn't even exist. It was, you know, we just went to the first stone at the end of the first day. So it was a lot of, on one hand, there was a lot of trial and error, but at the same time, we also were very fortunate because we basically got people from all over the world, scientists from all over the world, coming and giving us classes, like 1 or 2 week classes. Mm-hmm. So Zach Manion was the director at the time. And so, you know, he brought in a lot of people. So that's how I actually got to meet Conrad and other scientists that at the time we did not know were that famous. So it was good that we didn't know. So we have a more direct interaction. And before that I had worked with rats 1 year, and I had realized that was not for me. That's number one. I discovered I'm not doing non-human animal work, because especially lab work, it's just not for me. And I wanted something that incorporated the computational part, because I liked math, but I also wanted something maybe applied. But when I ended up deciding Connor's lab instead of other labs, it was more the supervision style, more than just the actual decision. I knew I wanted human decision making, but even within that, there's a lot of things. Maybe in the beginning I wanted consciousness, but then I realized consciousness is not that easy to study. Mm-hmm. So then I changed it. And I wanted to do some fMRI. And with Conrad, it was flexible. It would let me do things that I wanted. And at the same time, he had a lot of ideas. And some of the things I found very exciting. So I started it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say that I dreamt about Bayesian before, before I met Conrad. But I do remember in my master's asking questions and that were related. Clear, not everything should be. We don't think about everything like frequentists do. And then the professor at the time saying, yeah, there's also this field Bayesian statistics. We can give a class about it, but you know, and so it I think that's it. But I was more choosing the supervisor and then related with the different projects. Mm-hmm. The Parkinson's paper was a follow-up. That was something that I was interested in doing based on results that I'd seen in the previous research that I'd done in the lab.
Oh, okay. Can you tell us that story about the previous work that, you know, started there and then led to the Parkinson's paper?
Yeah. So again, because I wanted to have experience with the functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, Conrad at the time suggested, why don't we look at how prior and current sensory information are represented in the brain, in and more or less where is this uncertainty represented in the brain? And at the time, you know, fMRI was still hot, but at the same, it was when I started my PG, was also when that salmon paper came out.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, put the dead salmon in the scanner, they did not correct for multiple comparisons, and they saw brain activation. Mm-hmm. It's clearly given that the salmon was dead, it wasn't a real activation. So, but I, you know, I was still interested in fMRI, and that topic sounded interesting. So then I worked on it, and we collaborated with another lab that did fMRI, because again, my lab did not do that. And so I learned a lot from there. And at the time, one of the areas that was implicated in uncertainty in prior information was the putamen. And it was one of the most implicated, and that had some correlations with actual individual differences, which, you know, nowadays we know that for proper reliance, we probably need thousands of subjects, not 20. But, you know, that got me thinking. And it just happened that the lab was in the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. And so there was a lot of people coming with Parkinson's and other motor problems. So I thought, well, you know, if putamen is really this important, And we know that in Parkinson's, the putamen is not working as well, which is putamen's area in the basal ganglia, which, of course, you know better than me, but I don't know who else is hearing. That in Parkinson's, because of the low dopamine, that there's less activation from the putamen. And so I thought, well, if that's the case, and if the putamen is really implicated, then we ought to see differences in how people with Parkinson's and how people without Parkinson's do this task. And so that's what I ended up looking for. And it was a very interesting experience. I realized it's actually takes a long time to collect clinical samples. It takes longer if you don't have a direct medical doctor affiliation. So when we were just posting flyers, even though we were in the Rehabilitation Institute, and so there were clearly lots of people every day seeing the flyers because it's sensitive information and they did not know us, almost nobody signed up. Then we had a medical doctor that just was available to help us. Just the only thing she would say is like, you know, she's working with me, like if the avail, and that definitely increased the number of people that participated. Mm-hmm. So, and then we did both on and off medication for the same patients so that we would see the effects of dopamine. Mm-hmm. So that was a very, it was an interesting experience.
So can you describe the results from that paper? And
yes, so what I was hypothesizing based on the previous research with fMRI was that activity from the putamen and probably through dopamine would actually lead to increased reliance on current versus prior information. So generally, when you're making any decision, right, you can incorporate both what you are seeing right now with what happened in the past. So if I'm deciding, am I going to take my umbrella out? You know, is it going to rain today? I can look outside and see if there's, you know, if there's clouds in the sky or if it looks gray, then I'm more likely to think it's probably going to rain. And if it's sunny, I might not believe in it. At the same time, I can take out prior information. So like if I'm living in London where I lived before, or you know, in Seattle, then it's more likely that it will rain just because my prior information tells me it has rained several times before. And so we might, when we make decisions, we often combine this both prior information with this current information, mm-hmm. and we might give more weight, and that's what patient decision-making tells us, is that you are supposed to give more weight to the piece of information that is more reliable. Mm-hmm. So if it's really sunny, no blue, you know, no cloud at all, maybe, you know, that's a very strong indication it's not going to rain at least in the next hour. At the same time, if it's like there's some clouds, but not a lot, that gives you like, it's like maybe, you know, there's more uncertainty than maybe. And then if it does rain every day, you know, faithfully at 5 p.m., then you know it faithfully at 5 p.m. is probably going to rain. So then we take that information into account. Mm-hmm. And what we hypothesized was that dopamine would increase this reliance on current information relative to prior. So you would care a bit less about what happened in the past and more what is happening right now, what your senses are telling us right now. And this was what we saw. We saw people with Parkinson's when they were off medication compared to people with that were on medication, they relied less on current information compared. Yeah, but and we also saw that even within participants, if we compare them, and they were on their medication, meaning like they had just taken their medication within 1 hour versus they've been 24 hours without, was it 12 hours? I think 12 hours without the medication. Then when they were off the medication, they relied less on current information. This said, you know, this is still a small sample size. Mm-hmm. And so it's still not like for sure that this is always what happens, but there's converging evidence that dopamine at least is having an effect in deciding how much you rely on current versus prior information.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating result. And thank you for that really nice description of Bayesian decision making, basically. And so, like, what is it related? Do we think it's related to dopamine's role in learning? Like, what's the idea behind dopamine? You know, because these are tonic changes in dopamine levels, right? Where people take medication and they have a steady increase in their blood serum and presumably their brain concentration of dopamine. So there's some change in the tonic level of dopamine. So what is the thinking behind why, you know, that leads to an increased reliance on current information?
So, yeah, so it's all related with learning, right? So for you to learn something new, you kind of have to be paying attention to this new piece of information.
Mm.
Right? So you they are related, right? If you only rely on past information and you never look at the new evidence, you are not learning anything new. So there's just to be a balance between always updating so much that you never take into account, you know, what you've learned before. So if you're, then you are also never learning, you're just passively responding to stimulus, but you're updating it. And there's a lot of research, including from my postdoc supervisor, in the role of dopamine reward prediction errors, and just learning predicted errors. So there's some research also suggesting that even when there's no direct reward involved in the regular sense of getting a candy or getting money, then or getting juice if you are a monkey in the lab, then there's still this related with dopamine, right, which is related with learning. And you can think of that if suddenly you have a model of the world which is your prior, and then suddenly like there's a mistake, like what you are seeing does not fit at all with what you thought the world was, that gives you a prediction error and basically gives you more uncertainty on what your prior was. And so in this case, you are supposed to actually try to get more new, rely more on new information, try to go and get more information.
Mm-hmm.
So it also may be related with exploration and exploitation.
That's a great segue. So I think, you know, I think what the big gap is for people to understand how critical that is to a lot of neuropsychiatric diseases. You know, you're sort of implying that there's an optimal of many things. You know, there's an optimal amount of, like you just mentioned, sort of exploration, exploitation for any given situation. And there's sort of an optimal amount of learning that you need to do based on sort of these prediction errors, where the difference between, you know, what your brain is imagining the world to be and what it actually is or is being updated to be. And so can you talk a little bit about how just these slight changes, I mean, we're talking about pretty small changes in behavior can lead to, you know, or, you know, stem from a broad variety of neuropsychiatric disease, and how the relationship between decision-making and neuropsychiatric disease is not straightforward from the point of view of a lot of the classic theories about, for example, depression and having too little serotonin, or, you know, Parkinson's and just having too little dopamine, you know, how this sort of the dynamics are critical to understanding our current understanding of disease.
Yes. So that's actually more recently people have been trying to use this Bayesian framework to try to understand several psychiatric diseases. So, for example, autism is one of them, in which they thinking one of the theories is that it's that they are overexposed to sensory information. They rely, they will either like pay too much attention to sensory information, or sensory information is too strong, and so then you might have these sensory sensitivities effects. The same time with schizophrenia, right? Like if you are, you will see something, a stimulus that is actually ambiguous, could be signify several things, but you are kind of giving it too much weight because you think that this for sure means, you know, I don't know, somebody's going after me or something. And then it depends as well on the priors that you have built on your models of the world, not enough updating of both things. Now, this said, there's a lot of also understanding that these diagnostic categories are not, you know, it's not like everybody with a certain diagnosis will behave in this way, and everybody with a different diagnosis will behave in the other way, right? There's a lot of comorbidity and maybe just like specific symptoms within these disorders that could be explained in just how the brain is combining prior versus current information. And it might also depend, and we don't know because this field is still relatively new. It might depend that, you know, maybe do perceptual updating very well of your, like, here's just vision, but then once it goes to the social domain, then you don't know how to do it very well. It might be that it's just depending on certain, in the state that you are in that in certain states you actually do it very well, and at the moment you are more emotionally aroused and you cannot do it properly. So there's still a lot to learn, but I think one of the promises about this would be to explain some of these symptoms of psychiatric disorders that look weird from the outside, but actually they might be the best approach given how their brain works, or given how they think the world is operating. So this might be actually, they're actually doing the right thing given what they believe is happening.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's such an interesting idea. Do you have like an example of that you could discuss that might illustrate that point a little?
So this is a theory I've been looking for, even though so far the evidence I've collected does not point in the direction of the theory that I was thinking of. So that's also part of science. What you think is maybe happening is maybe not happening as well. In my postdoc, I worked with people with borderline personality disorder. And what I've, you know, they often, again, and I'm not a clinician, so this is just, I hear from these reports that they will shift often very fastly their opinion about themselves and others, their opinion, you know, they're basically the models of the world. They will often switch it very dramatically from one state to another, just based on very small pieces of information. And this sounds like as if their priors are not very strong, right? That they will just kind of overly update their information. So if somebody is a little late one time, it means, okay, it doesn't like me anymore, he's a terrible person. So they go like completely changes their mental model of the other person, right? Well, maybe if you have met this person for a while, then maybe you shouldn't update it as much. But there's also quite a few evidence suggesting that a lot of people with borderline personality disorder suffered either some form of child abuse or a lot of unstable environments. Mm-hmm. So maybe they were raised in an environment where their caregivers were always changing, their behaviors, and they were not consistent, or that their environments were not consistent. And so that they learned that priors are not reliable, and so that you have to kind of always be updating information. Mm-hmm. And maybe that would explain why some of their behaviors then in a different situation might not be as normative as they would be. So again, it's the behavior might be the best response but to a situation that's not happening anymore, but that did happen in their lives before. Mm-hmm. We still don't know, right? Like there's many reasons for it. Either way, I did a similar experiment with the sensory motor decision making task, and I don't see any difference. So they are as good as controls as at doing patient decision making. So it might be that it just happens in social scenarios, or it might just be that the hypothesis is totally wrong, which is also it in general, right? It might be that the people are doing the best approach given the environment they grew up in, that they just adapted to.
And so have you thought about it? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that this basic model is trying to explain the behavior in kind of an optimal light, even if behavior does not look optimal from one point of view, but it might be optimal from different points of view.
I love that framing because I actually think it's very helpful for, in a way, destigmatizing some of the, yeah. you know, the behavior and the conditions that people have. If we, because we all, we know that, you know, we have these kind of like throwaway phrases, like we're all a product of our environment and, you know, but this really formalizes that in a way and mathematizes it and says that, you know, well, actually, what could we expect from a person? What would we expect from a person who, you know, built very unstable priors throughout their childhood? Well, we would exactly expect this kind of, you know, decision-making that could potentially shift very rapidly based on changing current information, right? That is exactly what you would expect. And so it, there's, you know, absolutely nothing moralistic about that, you know, perspective, which is so important just for, you know, people's own, I think, you know, sense of self-identity, self-worth, but also for just, you know, improving access and, you know, to care and destigmatizing.
Exactly. Like, because I feel that often this like blame on the person, there's something, there's some flaw on the person. It's not the case, right? Even if it was like a purely genetic condition, which is not, and most conditions are not. But still, I mean, it's not your fault that you got the genes that you got, right? I mean, but even more when these are these adaptations to just the environment you grew up with and just these interactions. Of course, there's maybe some people that are naturally more susceptible than others, but there's a clear influence of the environment. And again, and there's this idea that, that, you know, okay, if you are characterized with a certain disorder, then you... there must be some deficit, but no, there's a lot of things that you might actually be good at, but it just depends on the environment that you're expressing.
Right? That is so critical, I think. And one message that we're trying to get across, I mean, and that speaks very directly to borderline personality disorder, right? It's a, we believe it's a trauma response, but it's a personality disorder. And in many ways, we don't consider it a, you know, a primary mood disorder, for example. It's not necessarily maladaptive. You know, it can often be limited in scope, just sort of like we're talking about, to very specific sort of things, you know, criticism about certain, you know, aspects of their life. But people can also essentially be optimized for an environment which is changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And in fact, my postdoc research paper that has yet to come out, because once you start faculty, working on your postdoc, it takes longer. But what I saw in this social decision-making task, they were actually even nicer at the beginning than people without the diagnosis. So it's not necessarily, it really depends on how you're evaluating the person, right? So if we understand what is going on, if we can explain it really, like what is going, then we can adapt the environment, at least the existing environment, the things we can control, so that they can actually thrive and not, you know, be put in a way in which they are at disadvantage.
Right, and I think people see a narrative that is not, like you said, just blaming them for behaviors that emerge, and they can understand that, you know, just like everybody, there are certain environments where they thrive, certain environments where they do better than most, and certain environments where they don't, you know, just like we all do. It just then shapes your quote unquote personality and the jobs that you pick and how you spend your time and how you, you know, how you live your life, and, you know, whether or not you would either change in a way to adapt or change in a way to structure life so that you're happier, you know, not facing, you know, challenges that are difficult for you to overcome and things like that. So the diversity aspect of it, I think, is so critical in the message, but it's complicated to convey, but that is a really good one.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it speaks to, even like when we were talking about our own experiences, again, if we are put in a different lab or in a different environment, we might not do well at all, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, yeah, fit given our lives. We might not be able to change how what happened to us in the past, but we can adapt now based on what is known, what we know about ourselves and how things work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it offers actually a lot of hope for people, right? That it's, you know, there's a potential to change, right? There's a potential to relearn, to learn new priors or to learn stable priors or to learn to be optimal in the environment the person is in now, which might be quite different from the environment that they sort of were originally optimized for, as we're, you know, in terms of the mm-hmm. we're talking about this.
Exactly. You continue.
No, I was just going to say, as a clinician, being able to offer that hope is so powerful because, you know, patients come into your office, and particularly with borderline, you know, there can be so much desperation around it, largely having to do with how people who have borderline or borderline traits have been treated by the system, that, you know, they often come in, at least, you know, when they see me, feeling pretty hopeless. Like, there's just no way, I have no way of thinking about this, you know, my experience of life that makes any sense and that offers me any sense of hope. But I think this kind of reframing can be potentially, you know, even just on the narrative level for the person, extremely powerful. And then obviously for the kinds of science we can do to try to develop new potential treatments as well. But
yeah, I fully agree. And I think it's in that regard, it's good to take into account the biases that people also have. So sometimes some clinicians might have biases against, you know, people with borderline or with other mm-hmm. disorders, right? And being aware of that and being aware that the way you are looking at data might be biased. Again, if you have different points of view in which people are not biased in the same way, then you can realize, no, actually, there's no really handicap in this, but it's just different ways of viewing the world. And there is hope. I mean, you still have to conform to the society how it is now in some way, because, you know, it is, society is what it is, but there's definitely hope. And with borderline, I know there's some, for some DBT, right, that generally works very well. It just, it's hard to access for everybody, but so there is definitely ways. And again, we can look at it as ways of curing or overcoming, or just, you know, even the society itself make it more friendly so that people with different experiences can actually thrive and use the special skill set that they do have. They might, you know, it's also a special skill, and use it, you know, in a good environment, basically.
And you bring up a really, really good point. And I think while we're talking about sort of this sort of novel view of borderline personality, and Alex should speak to this more than I will, but I'll bring up the topic. You know, we do know that, you know, DBT or dialectical behavior therapy works really well for patients with borderline, and much better than any, you know, pharmacological therapy, medication, not anything like that. And you're right, access is a problem. But, you know, in many ways, maybe, and Alex, weigh in on this, could you view DBT as sort of a reframing, you know, from this perspective, how would you look at DBT as a sort of treatment?
Well, I've been thinking about that the past 10 minutes and trying to come up with something intelligent. because my initial reaction was, in a way, it maps on an intellectual level more cleanly onto CBT, right? Mm-hmm. That we're reframing our beliefs and changing our belief structure and how we basically, you know, incorporate observations about the world into our belief structure and that kind of a thing. But DBT is very clearly, from the studies, the treatment approach that works best for borderline. There's no doubt about that. And it's very effective. So I have to, it could be just because I don't,
you know, a lot of modeling, though. I mean, there's like a lot of modeling, sure. Practice. I mean, it really,
there's a lot of practice
on posteriors, right?
That's true.
Trying to build up a repertoire of, like, you know, reactions, I guess, that are not extreme, right? It is basically focus on posteriors, and that's that. I think that's a, you know, I don't know, this is outside my expertise quite a bit, but from what I know about it, it seems like that is kind of the approach.
That's interesting. You both of you also know more in terms of actual the clinical, how you implement it. But there's some correlation as well between CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and DBT, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. So there's the overlap there. Yes, I see it better with CBT as well, but also that's because I know DBT a bit less. The idea of the posteriors frames well.
I know enough to know that I should tell someone to do DBT, but I don't, we're not actually trained on this stuff as psychiatrists very well, which is not that this is a tangent, but I wish we had more in-depth training and for instance, DBT, but mostly so I could say something, a lot more clever in this conversation than I'm able to. But no, but because it's such a powerful, effective therapy, and I end up recommending it for so many people, because, we don't just, it's not, the other thing right now is that everything's a spectrum, right? And so that's also true with borderline, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are many people who have, as kind of David was saying, more circumscribed parts of their personality that have borderline characteristics or borderline features, or it doesn't necessarily have to be that the person has full-blown borderline personality disorder, which of course people do, but many people more have parts of it. I end up recommending DBT even for people who, for instance, have major depression, which I know, how to treat, but then there are these clear pieces of, maybe it's affective instability or, relationship instability that is better described by kind of a borderline framework that I know that DBT would likely be very successful for that person as well. But yeah, it's definitely something I need to learn a little bit more about the details.
Yeah, and based on what you were talking about before, a recent discussion I was seeing on Twitter, often, right, when you label somebody with a certain diagnosis, then that affects their care and their even job mm-hmm. prospects later. So you have to be very careful. As a non-psychiatrist, at least I don't directly have to deal with it. But if the goal is to help, we can label a person with a certain diagnosis just to see what would be the best treatment. Mm-hmm. As clinicians and scientists, we also have to see what are the potential negative impacts of putting somebody in a particular basket, especially if there's stigma around that particular diagnosis.
No, I mean, that's hugely important. I think about that all the time. I mean, I take a very pragmatic approach to diagnostic labels in psychiatry. Whatever I think is going to actually help this person the most, actually, it's very justifiable because our diagnostic categories are abysmal, right? They're horrible. They're not, they're not very well evidence-based. They're consensus-based, but even more importantly, they can be interfering in some cases, right? Like you're saying. So, and I think most psychiatrists, know that because we go through training, trying to line up these diagnostic categories in the manual with this huge individual variability that we actually see when we, work with people. And so then you end up just saying like, what is going to be most helpful to this particular person? Yeah.
It does go both ways though. So it's a little bit interesting, many, I have noticed even in my practice and, in pain and some depression that, there's a lot more forthcoming from patients about, for example, borderline personality disorder being diagnosed with it. And I think in many ways, there is a generation of people, hopefully, typically younger, that really embrace having a diagnosis.
Sure.
And so in some sense, having a diagnosis, especially on the pain side, not necessarily borderline, but pain or something like that, people that have been struggling without a way to frame their suffering and what they're going through, they suffer way more not being able to label it as, you know, something specific. And oftentimes on the surgical side, I have to temper the practicalities of what surgery can help with, you know, offering a diagnosis. Mm. Now, these things can be at odds with each other, where I could do something very invasive and we could confirm a diagnosis, for example, Alzheimer's, right? I can biopsy the brain. I can give you a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or Lewy body dementia or something like that. But the marginal benefit of doing so is essentially nothing, right? Right. Mm-hmm. I can't offer you a new treatment based on that diagnosis, but there are many times and many examples when patients really want a diagnosis almost more than anything. And that mm-hmm. in itself is extremely therapeutic.
Well, that's hugely important. And I think that's where a lot of the art of medicine in this case comes in, which is knowing, because I for sure have had people who being told they have borderline personality disorder is actually hugely relieving, right? They all of a sudden have this is what I've been suffering, dealing with my whole life, and no one ever explained it to me, and now you've explained it to me. But that's all about how you explain that, right? If you convey stigma in your way of explaining it, then the person is going to feel that, you know, so yeah.
Which is why probably I think many people have suggested people renaming borderline personality disorder, because it's right. You know, it's not helpful, and you know, can be much more linked to trauma. You know, that mm-hmm. makes a lot more sense.
No, it's true. Like it is a trauma response, exactly.
Yeah. Trauma response disorder, mm-hmm. whatever. You know, although that is not a good acronym because we are using TRD for depression. So.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, we deal with this issue where we have a common set of risk factors, right, that can lead to many different things, but yeah.
Right. So I guess, you know, does that bring you hope for, you know, the complexity of this, I guess, even with these really beautiful, you know, computational models and where we're heading, does that bring you hope for the future about us understanding, or does that have to be, you know, a lot of people would say, well, you know, in psychiatry, we're going to figure all this stuff out. We're just going to have everybody with their Facebook app measuring every behavioral feature of every person on the planet. And then we're going to be able to use that as, you know, a way to understand these temporal and, you know, multidimensional patterns that give rise, and, you know, with a billion people, we'll figure this out, right? And that has to all be explained on the computational modeling side, right? Does that give you hope, or are your expectations for how this specific, you know, how this kind of inquiry and decision making is going to affect medicine, is that more tempered?
So I do have hope with this new computational psychiatry approach, especially with the connection between, again, we learn so much even just talking with clinicians and just hearing the actual experience rather than just, you know, what's written in the papers. And talking with patients will be the same thing every time I hear. I don't track, as I'm not a clinician, I don't often directly talk with patients, but having, again, this diversity of points of view, again, that really helps. And I feel that the field as a whole is both going towards more computational methods and also more reliable behavioral tasks and like bigger sample size. So it's moving in the correct direction. It's just a slow movement because there's constraints at all levels. But I am hopeful in the future. I don't think we are going to cure everything. I don't think we need to cure everything. In fact, we just need to understand it and make it in a way that, well, some things will be better if you could avoid them, obviously. Childhood abuse and those kind of things will be better, but something, it just is what it is. So if we can both understand it, try to mitigate it as much as possible, but then also just build more inclusive environments that we can to the different skills and points of view that I think that's the hope for the future.
Well, and that's such a good point, right? That we can actually change the environments and our acceptance of, I guess, the range of kinds of behaviors within those environments based around our understanding that people are coming into the environments with different models of the world, and therefore their behavior is going to be different, and we need to actually adapt. We need, as a society, to proactively create environments that are inclusive. Exactly. And like, as you said earlier, could even potentially take advantage of skills that people might be bringing that in a way are related to, you know, causes of suffering, I guess, but could also be adaptive in certain ways if we think about it, if we think about it that way.
Correct, right? Like for with autism, right? There's
exactly
certain skill sets that are, they do much better than like a person without a diagnosis. It just need to be given the right environment to work in.
Right, and I think that's a great way to reframe it. I always worry a little bit about a lot of the work sort of justifying the need for sort of these, you know, having diverse populations, because it's so patently obvious to me that it's necessary. And I feel like it's a little bit of like, I don't really need to justify any of this. This is just a tautology, but I understand it. And I think, you know, maybe the real 50% of the treatment for most of these neuropsychiatric diseases is actually, you know, encouraging that inclusive environment by educating everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Correct. Exactly. It wouldn't
be the same, you know, stigma associated all the time.
That's a very good point.
Well, thank you so much for joining. Or do you have something else, Alex?
I do have one more question. I mean, I think this is a perfect place to wrap up, but I had like one follow-up question from the Parkinson's thing, which is, you know, one of the things we wonder a lot about is if there's a common etiology for the non-motor and the motor symptoms in Parkinson's disease. And so I was curious if you think that there's a way in which this reliance on, or, you know, decreased reliance on current information, increased sensitivity to current uncertainty could potentially explain some of the movement problems that people have in Parkinson's. Like if the prior is a state of, I'm just completely speculating here, but if the prior is something like a state of inertia, you know, then, or, you know, maybe the brain needs actually an increased reliance on sensory information to initiate movement. Or something like that. I just was wondering if you thought all about that.
In fact, when I started thinking about it, I thought that, you know, like this framing would be a, you know, cure all kind of theory that would be explain everything, non-motor and motor. I'm now being more skeptical, maybe some parts are just very domain specific, and, you know, it's hard to fix everything. But it does fit very well, right? Like, so what I've seen again, and I don't have, as a non-clinician, I don't have a lot of experience with people with Parkinson's disease, but as a patient, I actually recruited these participants, and I saw, and the problem seems to be often, initiating, right? And once you initiate, you can go into this pattern that's easy. I remember seeing this video on YouTube, this person from the Netherlands, of course, that was with Parkinson's and could barely walk, and then, you know, the moment you put them in a bike, they could just bike normally because it was used to it. And I remember also hearing the story about people with Parkinson, but at an advanced stage that, you know, couldn't move, and they were like in the hospital, and then suddenly the fire alarm came out and they all came out of their beds and just went out. And at the moment they were out and they were safe, and they stopped and they froze again. So basically the idea would be you'll need this dopamine to like kick this new response and to do this new learning and to start this new behavior, and then you can have like your habits coming in and so forth. But you need a little bit of this, those dopamine to again, this is in a very simplified way, to like this paying attention to new information. And if it's the stimulus is strong enough, like a fire alarm or something dramatic, maybe you will act, but otherwise you might not. So I think it could explain both non-motor and motor. I don't know if it actually does, but those are interesting questions.
Fascinating. Well, yeah, thank you so much. This is such an interesting conversation. We really appreciate having you on.
Thank you. Thank you so much also for the invitation and the conversation. It's been great talking to you, and, you know, I'd love to continue. some point later off record. Yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, wish you both a great day.
Yeah, you too.